are now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Delphi podcast. Today I'm joined by Stephen and Ed Felton, who are two of the co-founders of Offchain Labs, which is one of the main contributors to Arbitrum. As a quick recap, Arbitrum is an optimistic rollup that processes transactions off-chain, but posts the results to Ethereum's mainnet for finality. If there's any issues, the users can submit fraud proofs to enforce transaction validity and go from there. Arbitrum is a layer two optimistic rollup, and per L2B.com has the highest TVL at nearly $6 billion, nearly double its competitor Optimism. And as a disclosure, we are investors in Arbitrum. Stephen, Ed, how's it going?
Great. Good. Great to be here.
We've rescheduled this podcast quite a bit. So to say that I'm excited is an understatement, but we're getting it done. So Stephen, we've met a long time ago. I remember like diligencing threshold encryption for a cross-chain play and seeing your initials on all the white papers and asking you if that was you. And it turns out it was you. It was a crazy turn of events.
Yeah, no, it's obviously, yeah, we've known you all for a while. And my journey in crypto started off more with a threshold signature, threshold ECSA or MPC signatures. And Arbitrum was an early project, which I worked on with Ed and Harry, and actually Ed worked on before I was even on. And but yeah, it's great to, it's been quite a journey and excited to still be on it.
Yeah, definitely. Ed, let's shift to you a bit. Tell us a bit about yourself before we dive into.
Sure. Yeah. I'm one of the co-founders of Offchain Labs. I spent a long time as an academic at Princeton University teaching computer science and public policy. I started working in the crypto space around 2011 or 12. And in early 2014, I got super excited about smart contracts, that smart contracts were going to be a huge change, huge improvement. They were going to be enormous. This is before there were any smart contract chains. But I started thinking immediately about, well, this stuff is awesome, but how is it going to scale? And that's really where the original work that led to Arbitrum started back in early 2014. So during this time, I was doing various crypto research, worked with some colleagues to write a textbook, and Stephen was one of the co-authors of that. And then in 2015, the story took an unusual twist. I went and worked at the White House for 2 years as Deputy U.S. Chief Technology Officer. Put Arbitrum aside during that time. Then I came back to academia, and one day these two PhD students, Stephen and Harry Kolodner, who's now our third co-founder, walk into my office and say, hey, remember that Arbitrum thing you were working on before? Let's do that again. So one thing led to another. We built an academic prototype. We published a peer-reviewed paper, and then we started the company. So that was
Ed,
2018, and the rest is history.
Can we please use your White House contacts to talk some sense into the government on crypto? I mean, I'm sure you've tried, but...
I have a lot of friends in Washington, and I've probably bent all of their ears about this. Yeah, but you can be the judge of how effective that was.
No, I'm sure it's helping. It's a cool story from academia, White House, back to, or not back to, but to Arbitrum, for Offchain Labs.
Yeah, I've tried. I mean, I've been an academic, I've been a government person, and now I'm a corporate, well, startup person. I'd actually find that the experience of each one is super valuable in helping to understand how to do the other ones.
Some people give flack to academics in crypto. Like some people say, like, you know, out of touch with the business world or, you know, too much research. But the reality is there's examples like you guys that have moved from academia to the business world and developed a very large project, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at academics, I think some academics are very practical minded, more in touch with what's happening out in the world. And I've always tried to work it. I always tried to work in that style as an academic to do work that was more practical and in touch kind of with reality. And hopefully that has shown out. Certainly we've learned a lot in running the company. But the other thing I'd say about that is that sometimes academics shouldn't be trying to be too much in touch with what's happening in the world. You're trying to... you know, you're trying to sort of, as an academic, you're trying to get ahead of where the industry is. So, and every now and then you have a success. And I think the beginning of Arbitrum is an example of this, right? Our team was working on how to scale smart contracts before there even were any smart contract blockchains. Because we could see that that was going to be a problem. And in this particular case, often, you know, you try to do that. You try to get ahead of where the industry is going to go. You often don't succeed, but sometimes you do.
Walk me through that a little bit. Maybe Stephen, we'll go to you. So, like, what was that like? So you guys foresaw the coming wave of smart contracts, realized Ethereum wasn't able to handle it, then started developing Arbitrum?
So I'll start here, but I'll ask Ed to continue because, you know, the early days is really Ed's story. But if you look back on YouTube and you look for the, so once upon a time, I would say search Arbitrum on YouTube, and there was one video. Now I say, if you look back on YouTube and, you know, dig through like the first mention of Arbitrum on YouTube, you'll find a video from a fall 2014 semester at Princeton. And I think the video was posted in January of 2015 and about Arbitrum. And this was actually before my involvement. I was actually part of that. It was a seminar on Bitcoin and blockchains back then. And I was part of that actually doing the project and Threshold and crypto work. But Ed led a project with some undergraduates where they were building Arbitrum. And the reason I like to mention that date is because to give you some context, Ethereum went live July of 2015. So this is, well before the launch of Ethereum. So back then it wasn't, we want to scale Ethereum only because Ethereum didn't exist yet, but it was really Ed looking at the initial smart contract designs from an academic context, again, to the point of, Ed before, academics are always trying to change the world and looked for problems before they solve problems, in ways that we don't know how to do yet, but really different academics have different time horizons. Some are trying to solve problems that might become, or build fundamental understandings that might become useful in 100 years from now or a few decades from now. And some are looking at things that they can apply to industry today. I think Ed's leaned always towards the earlier side. And in my research, I've also leaned towards, in fact, when I would speak with company, my research is always informed by speaking with companies. So it makes a lot of sense to be in a company. I'm always looking for those problems. But anyways, to get back to the story. So it was like, hey, the idea was, there's this cool thing called smart contracts. It's on paper now. Like, no system exists. And like, one or two things are clear that will happen. Either it will go away and like no one will be interested, or people will be interested. It will take off. And it was clear to Ed at that time that the plumbing sort of wasn't good enough for the demand that would come. And we needed to sort of fundamentally build some structures, some scaling structure around that. And Arbitrum was, it's changed a bit over time, but the fundamentals are actually pretty rock solid in many ways in terms of the interactive fraud proofs, which underline the protocol back then and underline the protocol today. And it was clear that we needed to build scaling technology to scale this not yet existent other technology. And that's, some of the benefits of academia, and really, Ed's foresight in a way that was really well ahead of its time. But I don't know, I feel awkward telling Ed's story that here. So Ed, feel free to correct any of that.
No, I'm not going to correct any, but I just want to add one thing. And that is that this was, when I had been studying in this time frame, 2014, I'd been studying Bitcoin, right? And so the idea of blockchain and so on was there. And then when I heard this idea of smart contracts, the idea that you could make it programmable, I immediately said, well, I've seen this movie before. I remember back in earlier in my career when I was younger, when we had the early version of the World Wide Web, right? And you could present static web pages to people, like words to read or images to look at, and nothing was interactive or moving or anything. And then there was this moment where the web became programmable with the introduction of Java and JavaScript, and like everything that came, basically our whole online world today grew out of that one sort of moment of taking this online thing, the web, and making it programmable. And so when I saw someone was going to take blockchain and make it programmable, I said, this is going to be just as big. And so I started thinking about, okay, so how is this going to go? What are the fundamental problems that this thing is going to run into? And one of the things that seemed really obvious early on was that if something like Ethereum is like a worldwide shared computer that everyone can kind of share, well, if everyone in the world is going to share this computer, you really better think about how to make it fast. Because if you're going to have millions, hundreds of millions, billions of users, you can't do it the way that Ethereum was planning to do it in those days. So like this scaling problem of how to make it scale up, that seemed like for me very early on, like it was going to be one of the most important problems. And that's why I started working on it back in 2014.
And the context here is today, this is like obvious. Everyone knows this. You spent a week in the blockchain space. This is like, the biggest problem we have, and everyone knows that everyone's working on it. But this is a decade ago and definitely ahead of its time.
Yeah. So I have to say, right, as an academic, I had my hits and misses. This was definitely one of the hits. But it's not like every time you come up with an idea, it turns out like this.
No, your foresight is incredible. I mean, I guess a key question I have is there probably wasn't a lot of positive feedback or momentum from 2014 till several years later, right? So you're kind of building this, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, like without interaction, without money, without tokens, without the community. How'd you stay interested in building something that early? Like what was the key?
Well, I mean, it was really early. And, you know, as a researcher, I'm interested in building things, doing proof of concepts. And so we did one proof of concept with these students. Then I had this interlude of working at the White House for almost 2 years where this was really put aside. So it was put aside for about 2 years. And frankly, in hindsight, it was maybe even helpful that that was the case. Because when I came back, Ethereum was more of a thing. It was more foreseeable that scaling was going to be an issue. And so when Stephen and Harry came to me and said, let's do this again, we built another more serious proof of concept that was closer to what we have today. It was still the case, though, early on. And Stephen often tells these stories about, you know, when we were going out fundraising early on for the company, trying to convince people that scalability and transaction fees were going to be a pain point for Ethereum users. Right. That was really a thesis of what we were doing. And a lot of people were skeptical of that early on. It seemed to us obvious that as this technology succeeded, that the demand for it was going to grow a lot faster than the capacity of the tech, unless something like Arbitrum actually got built.
Yeah. If you look back, yeah, when we initially raised funds in 2018, even then, you know, several years after sort of the initial aha moment that we sort of described, it wasn't obvious to people, certainly investors, that this was an investable problem. This was a problem that would have any immediate urgency to it. And it's, the irony is, so you know, we had some investors that shared our vision, and we raised a good round back then. We started building, and then really, really quickly got to the point where people were like, "Hey, why aren't you like, where is it? We need it. Like, why aren't you building it right?" And these are the same people that, you know, a few months earlier or a year earlier were saying like, "Yeah, we don't really think this is a problem." So, you know, these problems get, as you know, demand increases, these problems get very, very important very quickly. And the other thing to be said is, in that era, there were also other scaling solutions that were, you know, people at every point in time, I think, you know, people think that everything's done and decided already. And this is something we always fall into this trap of doing. And I'll tell you, like, I remember as a PhD student, I started getting into Bitcoin research in 2013. And I'm like, you know, I felt like every time I had a good idea, I would go to the Bitcoin forums, and like Greg Maxwell or someone else had already had that idea and already had the solution that I had in mind. And I'm like, wow, if only I just would have like been born 4 years earlier, I would have had all this great stuff. It's 2013. Everything interesting in blockchain has been done already. Like, this was actually my thought. And, you know, obviously in hindsight, that's funny. It's ridiculous. But I think even today we have that thought. And when we were raising, I remember it was like decided in many people's minds that these scaling solutions are Plasma or state channels. And we would come into investor meeting after investor meeting, and we'd ultimately describe our technology. And the question that we'd get in some form or other would be, okay, is this Plasma or state channel? And we'd be like, it's kind of this other thing, because the term roll up didn't exist yet in this context. It meant the thing you, a fruit you candy you eat, but it didn't mean anything in the blockchain space. And we had to sort of explain that to people. And actually, I remember at some point I capitulated. At the 2018 Cornell bootcamp, I remember, and this was actually where I initially met Vitalik, I gave a talk, and also I introduced the project of Vitalik, and I described it as Arbitrum, advanced state channels, which is not really, it's like sort of backfitting this technology into a different terminology, because we didn't even have the language. And you know, fast forwarding to today, I find the same thing happening today. And, you know, where people say, we've decided, some people say that and so we'll probably get to more of what we'll discuss today, we've decided that ZK rollups are the end game for scaling. Like, this is it. And then they'll cite certain people, and very smart people. And I'll remind people that we often get into this trap where we sort of think we understand things that we really, really don't. And the same way I was pushing against the narrative when it was Plasma and state channels, and some of the same people saying those things today, are saying those things today. So we, you know, I think part of being a researcher and a developer in this space and really making a difference is being able to think with an open mind. So just like back then, we weren't inhibited by the narrative that said, no, we have to build something that's a state channel, we have to build something that's Plasma. We were like able to think outside the box and actually go back to first principles and design a system that we thought was better than both of those, which turns out, you know, the general consensus now is we were correct. I think that there is a lot of that as well today, and it's easier for people to get caught up in the narrative of what they think people want them to say as opposed to actually going back and looking at the problems and saying, what is the best technology we have and how can we solve the real problems without any presumed answers?
That's awesome framing. I have to jump around and off the script a little bit on the timeline here of the conversation, because I have to ask. But so just thinking about how you and Ed were in a room, you know, many years ago, arguing against kind of the status quo, right? And explaining your technology, and it's kind of hard for investors to get it. Thinking through now, like seeing ZK rollups raise, seeing, you know, ZK EVMs and ZK VMs and, you know, yada, yada, all raise, putting yourself in their shoes and putting, say, you guys as the incumbent, is there anything that you would, you know, maybe say to them, or if you had to put yourself in their shoes, like, do you think that, you know, hey, maybe they are the future of tech. Maybe we are that incumbent that's going to get disrupted. Like, does that ever, the trip down memory lane reverse,
yeah, I mean,
ever come into play?
You have to be thinking all the time about what is coming. Are we doing the best thing? I think, you know, we have had this philosophy from the beginning that we're going to think from fundamentals and we're going to pick whatever technology best solves our users' and developers' problems. And I think today that's still optimistic rollups, and it will continue to be. And I think when you go to the fundamentals, what is the cost? What is the simplicity? Which systems are the cheapest to operate? Which systems give you the most flexibility for developers? Which systems can evolve and more quickly to add new functionalities or bring on more developers? I think optimistic has a lot of advantages. But nonetheless, you know, we have to be looking. And if the day comes when we decide that ZK technology is a better solution than what we're doing, we'll switch. We're not wedded to the particular technology. We're really wedded to the idea of choosing the technology that we think is meeting people's needs the best.
And one place you can actually see this really obviously is just the name of our company compared to the names of some others and our competitors, whereas, you know, some of our competitors will have either the term ZK or Snark or Stark or Optimistic built into their name. Just about all of them do. You know, we're off-chain labs. You know, the product that we built is the Arbitrum tech stack. And, you know, nowhere there does it say anything Optimistic or ZK. And the idea is there's a very subtle difference, I think, between our mission and some of the other missions in this space. Some people have a mission, which is our mission. Their mission is to scale blockchains using, say, ZK technology, or like scale blockchain using this tool, and that's their mission, and it's built into their name, it's built into who they are. And our mission is not that. Our mission is not scaling blockchains using Optimistic technology. Our mission is scaling blockchains using the best technology available to do that, and also building and researching and, you know, contributing to the best technology available to do that. And to Ed's point, you know, we still believe that there were a few breakthroughs away from ZK being competitive with Optimistic rollups today, from a maturity perspective, from a cost perspective, from a flexibility perspective. We can go into that if we want to. But the idea is that there's nothing fundamental that's saying, other than our repeated and current analysis. It's not an analysis that we made 5 years ago when we formed the company, and we're sort of stuck with that narrative today because we put all our eggs in that basket. We renew that narrative every day. You know, we have really strong cryptographers on our research team that are looking into ZK tech and saying, is it, you know, does it make sense for us to incorporate it partially or at all? And the answer today is exactly the stack that we've built, we think is the correct answer. But I can tell you this, if we fast forward 5 years from now, the Arbitrum tech stack today will not look like it does. The Arbitrum tech stack then will not look like it does today. It will have made many, many advances just because there are so many people in the space, entering the space, smart people that are researching and furthering these technologies. And it's clear that we'll have advanced in ways that we can't imagine today. The bet that we haven't taken is which direction that will go. Will it be in ZK technology? Will it be in programming languages innovation like Arbitrum Stylus? Will it be a combination of all them? I don't know. And I don't have a bet there. And we're going to be flexible from Off-Chain Labs' perspective, from the technology that we build and we advocate for, to use the best technology available. So if ZK turns out in the long run to be better than Optimistic technology, you're not going to see me or Ed fighting against it. I haven't made that conclusion yet today, but I also haven't set up our company in a way that requires us to make a conclusion about the future, which I think is a really strong benefit.
Yeah, the flexibility is big, right? I mean, from the company perspective and just in your minds, you know, you two having the flexibility to embrace a new technology if it were to come out, right? A lot of founders, I mean, a lot get stuck in what they're doing and it becomes siloed off. But let's spend a little bit of time on the core technology, on the Optimistic side today. So, like, how do you both feel about the end game for optimistic rollups in general? I know you guys are open to ZK, but maybe we could start with just a brief kind of definition of how optimistic rollups work, and then we could kind of get into the future.
Yeah, let me talk some about how, at least about how Arbitrum works. The key idea is that that someone can make a claim, post a claim on Ethereum about what is the correct outcome of execution of Arbitrum, and they stake on that claim. And then if some period of time passes and no one challenges that claim, then the Arbitrum protocol will accept the claim, right? If within that period of time, someone else challenges the claim, now you have two competing claims about what the correct outcome is. And now there's a challenge protocol that happens between them. And sort of the part of the secret sauce, the so-called interactive fraud proofs, is a way of resolving that challenge, that disagreement between two parties about what the correct outcome is, very efficiently. So the real advantage of an optimistic rollup is, and I should say in this process, if someone is making a claim, they're staking on that claim. And if your claim is rejected, you're going to lose your stake. And so that gives you an incentive to tell the truth, right? And so in the normal case, in an optimistic rollup, someone makes a correct claim about execution and they stake on it and it's correct. And so no one objects to that, right? The first person stakes correctly because claims correctly because they don't want to lose their stake. And no one challenges that because no one wants to lose their stake with a bad challenge. And so after the time interval elapses, then that claim gets accepted and on you go. And the beauty of this is that you never have to do a challenge or a proof. So unlike, say, a ZK system where every single time someone makes a claim, they have to generate a proof very expensively, and that proof needs to be verified on chain. In an optimistic setting, someone makes a claim, and if no one challenges it, it just gets accepted without needing a heavyweight proof mechanism to happen. That's what makes it optimistic.
No, that's really helpful. So just correct me if I'm wrong here. Just so zooming out, a lot of applications are built on Arbitrum. There's a lot of transactions happening above Ethereum. Eventually, these transactions are compressed, settle down to Ethereum, and there are no fraud proofs every time. It's only if somebody foresees a problem, they can stake their claim and argue that something bad has happened.
Yes, that's right. So if two parties in particular, right, so all the transactions that get posted, that get sent to Ethereum, to Arbitrum, will eventually be batched together and compressed, and they'll be posted on Ethereum as like an authoritative record of which transactions arrived at the Arbitrum chain and in which order. Then parties can make claims about what is the result of executing those transactions, which blocks will get built from those transactions, right? And as we've said, if nobody disagrees, the first claim that's made, if no one disagrees with it after a while, it'll get accepted. If there is a disagreement, now the secret sauce of the Arbitrum protocol comes in. It is a way for the protocol to determine on the merits which claim is correct. It's a big difference from sort of L1 chains, which are consensus, which is kind of like voting. Here it's resolved on the merits. And that means if one person makes the correct claim and a million people say something else that's wrong, the one who's correct will win. So it's a very strong security guarantee that you get in this protocol.
Has there ever been a successful fraud proof on Arbitrum? Has there ever been like one of these claims in reality?
On mainnet, no. But it has happened. It has happened a few times. For example, when the Ethereum merge happened and Ethereum switched to proof of stake, Ethereum at that point, it was a hard fork. And so there was a branch of Ethereum, which died out pretty quickly, but which existed, called ETH POW. And this was a branch of Ethereum that had not adopted proof of stake. And so on that branch, someone did try to make a false claim in order to steal some of the funds on that sidechain. And that actually happened twice. And both times they were challenged. The challenge protocol ran and the false claim was defeated. This is also something that happens a lot in testing. It's happened on some test nets, but probably the closest to a mainnet example is the two examples on ETH POW. But it's kind of the beauty of the Arbitrum protocol that because of the incentives that are created by staking, people really don't want to try a false claim because you're going to lose money. You're certain to lose, right? The dispute is going to be adjudicated on the merits. And so if you're wrong on the merits, you will lose. And so there's no reason to make a false claim where you will lose your stake.
So, Ed, I'd love to talk about like how a malicious actor would go about doing this. But one of my interim questions, though, is like, how much do you have staked to even argue that there is a false claim out there, right? Because if I'm a malicious actor, like my next step is let me get a lot of arbitrum to argue that this isn't wrong, right? Or it is wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So the staking is done currently in ETH. The stake right now is not too large. But I think one of the really important things here is we're going to move, the stake will probably get larger. Right now, participation in this protocol is permissioned to a set of parties. But when it becomes permissionless, we expect it will become permissionless, and we expect then that the stake will get larger. But one of the really nice things about the Bold protocol, which is our next generation challenge protocol, is that it allows parties to pool their stakes. So if the stake is 100 ETH, let's say, and you have 1,000 people, each of them has a tenth of an ETH, a couple hundred dollars, they can sort of do a Kickstarter type thing where they each put in their portion of the stake. And if it adds up to enough, they can act as a staker in the protocol. And the key aspect of that, of course, is that this is safe for them to do. It's trustless. Even if some of the other parties who you're pooling with turn out to be dishonest, if they're trying to stab you in the back, you're still protected. And so all you need is one party to stake on the true outcome, and people can pool their money to make that stake, and they can do that safely.
That's pretty cool. No, it definitely lowers the barrier. And one thing I'm a little confused about, I'd love to spend some time on, is just the attack route for a malicious actor on Arbitrum, right? Like if I'm a DeFi application and let's say I'm trying to steal funds or, you know, screw with the order flow or whatever it is, like how would somebody go about attacking Arbitrum just start to finish, like your developer?
Yeah. So let's say, so in the Arbitrum protocol, there's this thing called an assertion. And what that is someone's claim about what is the correct outcome of the chain at some level. Someone can say, you know, block number such and such will have this hash. And that basically is a claim about the whole history of the chain up until that block. Right. And then they stake on that claim, and eventually the protocol will decide, yes, we're going to accept your claim, or no, your claim will be rejected and we're going to take your stake. Right. Okay. So now let's suppose that some party wants to cheat. They can post an assertion that includes a false outcome. Let's say, you know, I want to steal your money and I'm malicious and also irrational, because you have to be irrational to try this. I could just post a particular claim about some block in which all of your money now belongs to me, right? And so I, you know, the hypothetical evil, irrational me would post this assertion and stake on it. And now anyone else in the world at that point can say, no, that's not correct. This is the correct thing. They post some other claim about what that block is. And as soon as you have two competing claims, now what's happened is the Arbitrum chain has forked. And the challenge protocol is going to identify which branch is correct on the merits, and it's going to prune off the one that's wrong. So I made my false claim. Someone else made a true claim. Now I and they will get into a challenge protocol. And this challenge protocol, and we could dig into how it works, but it guarantees that the party who's right can win the challenge. So in our scenario where I made a false claim, someone else, anyone came in and made the true claim, they will defeat me in the challenge. And the result is I'll lose my stake and my branch will get pruned off. And then now there's only one branch of the chain. And so everything just continues. That's kind of the scenario of back. And that's really what happened in these POW examples. Yeah.
No, it's really interesting. So why is it that anybody can come in with the real authentic information despite their size and wit? Like, why is it that the altruistic actor wins versus this large malicious actor with a big stake?
Well, let me talk a little bit, right? It's partly because it's not voting, right? If it's voting or if it's who has the biggest stake, then you do have this problem that either a lot of voices or someone pretending to be a lot of voices because they're rich can win. Yeah. So basically, let me talk sort of really roughly of how this works technically. So suppose that the two, Alice and Bob, have a dispute, and they have a dispute about a million blocks, right? So they agree on what the block is at the beginning, and they disagree about what the state is a million blocks later. So what the protocol does is it goes to Alice and Bob, and it says, okay, Alice and Bob, tell us what you think the block is after half a million blocks, halfway through that, okay? And now there's two things that can happen. Either they agree about what is the case halfway through, or they disagree, right? So if they disagree about the state halfway through, now you have a disagreement about 500,000 blocks, right? The first half instead of a million. Or alternatively, they agree about the halfway point, and now you have a disagreement about the second half, also a disagreement about 500,000 blocks. So by the simple method of saying, each of you tell me what the midpoint looks like to you, and saying same or different, you can then take a million block disagreement and cut it down to half a million blocks. So you cut the size of the dispute in half. You can do this over and over. With a million blocks, you'll have to do it 20 times until you get down to a disagreement about just one block. And so it's this sort of breaking it down. And again, you can show that the party who is a party who always tells the truth is going to win this protocol. In other words, you'll get down to a difference about a single block where the party who's telling the truth is making a correct claim and the other party's making an incorrect claim. And so you sort of divide down by cutting the disagreement, by cutting it in half, until the disagreement is so small that it's really easy to check who's right. That's awesome.
I just listened to Jordan Peterson's new podcast, totally unrelated, but his guest was talking about the tit for tat strategy of game theory on negotiation, and this sounds pretty similar. Like the two sides are arguing until you narrow it down to some one block.
Right, and the beauty of it is that, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you have or how loud you are or whatever, because whoever's right, you can. It's, you know, it's easy to prove at a technical level that the person who always tells the truth will always win this game.
So, Ed, my last question, because I'm at the edge of my technical knowledge here, but when you find that final block, how is it that the altruistic actor is able to prove the right way of the world?
Once you've bisected down to a single block, now the code that generated that block executes instruction by instruction, sort of at the sort of almost like a machine instruction level.
Okay.
You can then bisect down into that block until it's literally just one instruction of execution, like one add instruction that adds two numbers, right? And so Alice is claiming this is an add instruction. It's adding 2 + 3. The result is 5. And Bob is claiming something else. Well, Alice can just say, look, it's an add instruction. Here's a proof of that. Here's a proof that it's an add instruction. Here's a proof that the two things we're adding are 2 and 3. And then the verifier, which is a contract on Ethereum, says, okay, 2 + 3, that's 5. I know this. So you really do, you just divide it down to a really atomic level disagreement. And then an on-chain contract can just check.
That's cool. I mean, I hope there's a way to gamify this where people could sort of watch in the stands and see the gameplay.
I mean, we do have some cool visualizations that we've built in testing. In our testing, we actually have things where you can see kind of an animation on your screen as a dispute goes on of the different parties and what they're claiming. You can see the dispute, the sort of fork get smaller and smaller.
The real gamification and incentives here is you'll hear when you talk to some ZK teams that they like to say this thing, which is actually not true, that, oh, optimistic rollups like Arbitrum are based on game theory. But that's not true at all. You know, if you followed, you know, what I just said, like it's basically refereed by Ethereum. It's a deterministic process to get there. There's no game theory involved in any of that correctness guarantee. Where, though, there are incentives involved in terms of gamification is you want to disincentivize people from, like, engaging this process frivolously. So anyone can, or anyone who's, within the Bold protocol, actually anyone can go ahead and engage the challenge protocol. So if they disagree, they can go ahead and unilaterally engage this and get Ethereum to do the right thing and make sure the right thing is true. But you don't want people just sitting on their couch doing these fake challenges. And that's where the incentives come in, and you stake some funds on demand when you want to do an action, and you'll lose those funds. And like I said before, you could even pool those funds, but those funds will be lost in the event that you sort of were wrong and could just do disincentivize bad behavior in the system. But again, that's the core correctness and security property here is guaranteed by the Ethereum being the referee, by the soundness of this protocol, and by nothing else. And it's, you know, kind of think of it like an anti-spam actually. You don't want people spamming, so you have some protections there. But ultimately, if you want to send that spam email, you can. You'll just have to engage in the process and put down the challenge and lose it if you're not doing the right thing. But the cool thing is, if you are doing the right thing, if you are honest, you know that you can engage and you won't lose your deposit either.
Yeah, that's sort of the characteristic of an optimistic protocol, right? That it is, it's always correct. If you're honest, you will always win. And it is super efficient if people follow their incentives.
Yeah, I feel like I have a really good understanding of it now. I did not know that's how it worked.
Yeah, and by the way, if someone tries to cheat, yeah, it costs something to have that dispute game, but guess what? You're also taking a deposit from them. So that's kind of the beauty of an optimistic protocol like this, is that it only costs when someone cheats, and you can make the cheater pay for that cost.
One of the concerns I have, like, from Wall Street days that I always, like, I brought this up with Eigenlayer on our podcast, I bring it up with, you know, wherever it's applicable, is just the idea of, like, cascading issues if, you know, an issue is figured out, right? Like, the idea that a small blowup somewhere has this butterfly effect over the whole Arbitrum protocol. If somebody if you successfully find out that, you know, something is wrong, right? And, you know, maybe Arbitrum kept moving forward and there's millions of transactions. What is the actual effect on the timeline here if you find out something happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, you could imagine the worst case, right? And there's various bad cases, but one of the bad cases is the chain somehow gets wedged, can't make progress, or else something bad seems to be happening. Right? This could only happen if there was a critical security vulnerability in some of the core software. But of course, you can't rule that out absolutely in any system. And so this is where, in practice, for the Arbitrum One chain, this is the role of the Arbitrum Security Council. The Security Council is a group of 12 people that is elected by the Arbitrum DAO. And by the way, as we're recording this, it's just about the closing time of one of the twice annual elections. And so those 12 people are elected by the Arbitrum DAO. And they can take emergency action to address or fix a problem if needed. That's basically their job. In the worst case, if something terrible is about to happen, if there's a security emergency, the Arbitrum Security Council can step in. They can pause the chain, or they can push an emergency upgrade if needed. And this is the strategy that we envisioned and that now the Arbitrum DAO is carrying out and continuing to do, that that gives you the flexibility to respond to security emergencies should that be needed. And it's important that it's 9 of 12. It's a large group, and you need almost all of them on board. It's important that they're elected by the Arbitrum DAO. It's important that only 2 of the members are affiliated with any one organization. So it really is a diverse thing. It's not like it's 10 of our employees and 2 other people. It really is a diverse group. There's no one organization that has get enough votes to take action or even to block action by the Security Council. So I think it's a really nice way of dealing with the absolute worst case. Has never been needed, but it's nice to know it's there.
One thing, though, to sort of speak about, like, a more intermediate case, which I think there's a misconception here as well, to sort of, you know, walk you through. So some people say, like, let's say, because people know there's this, like, 7-day challenge period. So let's say 5 or 6 days in, something happens, and it turns out the block was wrong. Some people think that, oh my gosh, is the chain going to unroll for 6 days? And the answer is no. And let me give you a mental model, like a blockchain mental model, to think about this. You know, think about Ethereum forks. So there's an Ethereum fork that's correct, and then there's some random fork that did the wrong thing. And then that goes on for some time. Anyone, like, running a node and following the Ethereum protocol doesn't really worry about that there's another fork that's wrong. They just keep building on the correct fork. And that other fork, they'll just basically ignore for perpetuity. So that fork can go on for days or months or years. And we actually have forks of the Ethereum protocol. We mentioned one earlier on this call, EthBow, and we just sort of ignore that. We don't care. That's not the fork we're following. We have, you know, we're following the correct fork. It's actually the same thing in layer two is actually it's an even stronger guarantee in arbitrum. So when someone, if someone does something fraudulent or there is a bad transaction and they and a validator puts that claim in, so yes, there will be a 7-day process in which someone follows that. But the honest guys aren't waiting around looking what happens there. They're running their nodes. They know what the correct transactions are, and they're continuing to build on the honest fork. And it's the same thing. There's a good fork and a bad fork. The cool thing is, whereas in Ethereum on a layer one, there's never like a ground truth that will get rid of that bad fork. We'll just continue on and we'll ignore it. In Arbitrum, Ethereum will actually, within you know a roughly 7-day period, go ahead and stamp and say, no, that's the incorrect fork. Follow along with the correct fork. But everyone else already knew that, right? It took Ethereum 7 days to figure this out. Everyone else already knew that. So if you're running a node or you're following someone that, you know, just like in Ethereum, either you're running your own node, you're looking at Etherscan, who you trust, your Alchemy, you know, the same players, either you're running your own node or you're trusting a node that, you know, by someone else, run by someone else, you know immediately where the correct node is. So just because someone tried to do something bad in Arbitrum, sure, Ethereum will deal with that, has a process, has a fraud-proof process, but you continue building in the correct path and you actually have the knowledge here that Ethereum will actually tell the world that you're correct in a couple of days. No different than a blockchain, a layer one blockchain fork, only different that you actually will actually get a definitive answer, whereas in layer one, they'll just sort of ignore them forever.
Yeah, and when I was talking about the Arbitrum security council, I was talking about the absolute worst case where some, you know, there's some unforeseen major security problem in the Arbitrum protocol itself, right? Normal operation of the protocol, if someone makes a false claim, some nodes just go right down the correct branch and don't notice. A lot of nodes will probably say, oh, look, there's a garbage fork. All right, let's go kill that. But for normal users, life just goes on.
No, this is helpful. I guess I'm still just a little confused, though, on like the user flow, right? Like if I'm a DeFi project on Arbitrum, let's take whatever Perps Project 5, right? And the core developers steal $1 million and they go deposit into all these other Arbitrum projects. I don't know what's going on. I'm just a casual user who got rugged. Like, how is that pruned? Is that like when they go to withdraw? And I'm probably confusing something here, but
yeah. So here's the thing. There is a correct answer for what did the Arbitrum chain do, right? And the Arbitrum chain didn't actually give those people all of your money. If they were like trying to cheat in the Arbitrum protocol, there is a correct answer. And the only thing, the thing about this is that it, there's a correct answer. Everybody knows it from the beginning because everybody knows what are the rules of the chain. How does, you know, given these set of transactions, what should the blocks be? Right. Everybody knows what the correct outcome is. The only quote unquote person who doesn't know is the Ethereum chain. So how does a normal node know what the correct answer is? Well, it just executes all the transactions, follows along with the chain. Right. So everyone who has a computer could do that. You know what the correct state of the Arbitrum chain is, and you don't have to worry about any of this nonsense. But back on Ethereum, right? Ethereum doesn't have as much computing power as your laptop. No matter how lousy your laptop is, Ethereum doesn't have enough capacity to execute all of the Arbitrum transactions. That's kind of the point of scaling, right? You want to be able to do more than Ethereum can do. Right. And so because Ethereum can't follow along and actually execute all the transactions for itself, like literally everyone else in the world can, we have to have this protocol for proving to Ethereum what the correct outcome is. But the key thing is everyone else knows what the correct outcome is. This is all just about convincing Ethereum what the correct outcome is. So the way I would say it, the way I would interpret, tell your story is, somebody is not that these people took money from their users. It's that they lied and said that they had taken money from the users, right? It's like someone doesn't, they didn't actually rob the bank. They just like walked down Main Street saying, hey, we robbed the bank and these bags are full of money, when actually they aren't. The question is just, they never actually did it. That never actually happened. It's just that they might be able to get away with that walking down Main Street for a while until someone says, hey, buddy, open your bag. I don't think there's any money in there. The thing has already happened. It's just a question of proving what it was that happened.
To illustrate, like using the layer one example again, you could ask the same question of Perp5 protocol on Ethereum. Let's say they go ahead and say, hey, here's a fork of the Ethereum blockchain. We took all your money. And your answer would be, well, I don't know what that fork is, but my node doesn't agree with that fork, and Etherscan doesn't agree with that fork, and Alchemy doesn't agree with that fork, et cetera, et cetera. So you're like, okay, you have a fork that does this, but that's not the correct blockchain fork, and so I don't really care. So yeah, you have some corrupted system that you're showing me, but that's actually not the correct one. It's simply an Arbitrum. You can go ahead and carry this bag and say, hey, you know, here's a fork of Arbitrum that we're asserting is correct. We took all your money, but you're going to say, well, that's not what my node is saying. That's not what Alchemy is saying. That's not what Etherscan is saying. And by the way, that's not what Ethereum is going to say when it finishes engaging its process. You just sort of happily ignore that, knowing that Ethereum will get rid of that. And you just look at the correct fork. And in the correct fork, there's absolutely no way that they did take your funds. And that's just not possible.
Yeah, I feel like the term optimistic might be doing a bit of a disservice to Arbitrum.
Yeah. I mean, there is this sort of misconception that what happens is people do some stuff, and then if it turns out to be wrong, it gets rolled back. But that's not, I mean, and some optimistic rollups do work that way. But Arbitrum does not. In Arbitrum, people can claim alternate different histories of what happened. And what the protocol does is everyone is entitled to their own claim, but ultimately the protocol will prune off the claims that are proven to be false, and only the true one will remain standing.
So I have to give you guys a lob of a question here, because I've had on ZK projects, we've invested in ZK projects, but you know, we're here to debate the other side of the story here. A lot of the catchphrase of ZK is, you don't have to worry about challenges or anything because everything is automatically secured by math, right? This whole idea that all this stuff happens on top, all these crazy millions of transactions, it's rolled down to ETH, it's enforced by math, nothing's ever wrong. What am I missing in that broad statement, which lacks all sorts of nuance?
Well, I guess, I mean, let me give you an answer that lacks the same amount of nuance, which is a bit unfair. And that is that Arbitrum guarantees you the correct result also. And having complicated math is not, in fact, a plus. It's expensive, and it makes it hard to understand, and it raises the risk that you did something wrong.
When you say expensive, Ed, where is the expensive part? Is that the off-chain part?
It's in the proven. Well, it's two things. There's two things that are more expensive. Proving is more expensive, which happens off-chain. And this requires a lot of really complicated mathematical calculations to do the proofs, right? This is where the incredible complexity of the ZK math comes in, that there's a large number of very complex mathematical calculations you need to do in order to generate one of these proofs. And that's a thing that, so in an optimistic system, if a smart contract does an add instruction, an optimistic implementation needs to add two numbers. The ZK prover needs to add two numbers and then do like 1,000 complex mathematical operations to prove the result, right? And so it's a big cost advantage there on the proving side. But then also for ZK, you have to verify these proofs on chain every time. So ZK does proving every time. Optimistic does proving almost never. And when the proving has to happen, the cheater pays for it. So there's a big cost advantage. Number one, it's inherent cost advantage. The ZK people say correctly that their cost disadvantage has gotten smaller over time, but I think it's still pretty significant. And you can't get cheaper than zero.
The other aspect to tackle the ZK claim sort of head on, and this is probably my spiciest take I'll give today, is I think that statement that ZK is secured by math is actually not true. And so, you know, Ed did, I think, a fantastic job, which I agree with fully, speaking about the benefits that we have and the fact that the contrast that they're trying to set up there is not correct. But I think even taking that directly head on to talk about the ZK world for a second, it's actually not true if you look at how these systems are used, because we've talked about cost, but the other important thing to talk about here is time to generate these proofs. These proofs don't pop up. I submit a transaction on chain and boom, instantly I have a ZK proof of that. That's not the way that these systems work. These systems work where I submit a transaction on chain and then it takes a significant amount of time, and they've made good progress here. So I don't know the current numbers, but it's definitely in the many minutes to, in some protocols, hours, depending on how they're configuring them. So many minutes to somewhere between a couple of minutes to a full day. If you want to span the gamut of ZK programs today, and they've done a good job in reducing this, to get a ZK proof. Now, think about the user now for a second. I'm a user. I'm submitting a transaction on chain and to a ZK rollup, and you're saying we don't trust anything but math. Well, that would mean what we need to do at this point is stop and wait for that math, right? The math is the proof. But remember, the proof takes a long time to generate. And then another is, so I send you, Tommy, I send you an ETH on a ZK rollup, and that's proven by math. Now you want to go ahead and send that ETH to Ed. But hang on a second. You can't do that until the math has concluded that you actually have that ETH. But the math is going to take on the order of many minutes to a day for that to happen. So what does ZK rollups do? Do they stop after every transaction, after every batch of transactions, wait for that proof, lock up those funds? No, they don't. What they do is actually they build optimistic systems on top of ZK rollups. So the idea is for the period of time, you know, again, some number of minutes to the order of day, depending on which rollup you're using, you're relying on an optimistic guarantee from the ZK rollup sequencer that's assuming that the math will follow at some point, but allowing you to spend those funds beforehand. And so the idea is, you know, in a world of instant ZK proofs, yes, you could have a system solved by math. I don't think we know how to get to instant ZK proofs. I don't even think that's on the realm of possibility in any near term. You know, I'll think of years to decades. I don't think that anyone's actually working towards that. So all these systems build optimistic systems on top of them. And, you know, if you're a trader, your assets are in and out of your wallet by the time the math has come, and you're relying fully on that system. By the way, so what are the risks? You know, we talked about relying not on math. So yeah, sure, there are risks that are involved, because if the ZK rollup, and this gets to the point of centralization as well, who's creating these proofs? It's some centralized ZK server. Often the public doesn't even have the data to create the proofs, right? You send it to them and they'll create the proofs. You might not even have the data. Again, you may, depending on which blockchain it is and how they post their data, whether they post input data or output data, but then that's a bit complicated. But the idea is they're going to go ahead and submit one of these proofs, and you're going to have to wait for that to come, and you're going to assume it's coming. But let's say it doesn't come. Well, you just had a big problem, because you thought that I sent you that money. You already sent it to Ed, and now it turns out that there was a reorg and the prover never came. So until you actually have that proof on Ethereum, you don't have any mathematical guarantee. You have at best an optimistic guarantee. If you put the data on Ethereum, you might even have a worse guarantee that you're just trusting the sequencer. So I think that statement is a bit misleading. And it's one I've seen many times with ZK rollups, and I'm always happy to push back on that one.
It's crazy ironic building optimistic systems.
Well, that's the thing. Optimistic systems, if you want something that is really cheap and fast, optimistic approach is the way to go. That's why we're using optimistic systems. We're not adding on another very complicated layer in addition to that.
Is there anything that you guys like that your ZK competitors are doing? Is there anything that you're jealous of, like, would commend, like, wish you had? I'm just curious, because you guys go back a long time on this, right? You know the critiques, you know the issues with it, like, you're open to embracing it. But is there anything now that you wish you could just drag and drop?
I mean, look, if ZK proving was incredibly fast and cheap, I think we would just drag and drop it in. It's a little more complicated than that, but not too much. Yeah. The other thing that I think is important here is that people really fixate on the proving technology, but in fact, the bulk of what it takes to run a layer two chain is in stuff other than proving. In order to build a really complete system, you have to do a bunch of other things. You have to worry about bridging of assets. You have to worry about user experience. You have to worry about how you handle the transaction data. You have to worry about sequencing, which is a whole other piece that we haven't even gotten into yet. There's just an awful lot of things that go on. When I think about what are the problems, say, that our research team is engaging in as we think about, you know, what this space is going to need over the next months to years, really proving accounts for a pretty small fraction of where I think the advances are going to come. I think most of the advances are going to come outside of proving. And that's why we, you know, have, for the most part, found a proving approach that we think is really cheap, fast, and flexible. And we've done a ton of innovation outside of the prover. And that also, I think, is an area where, and I feel like that innovation is easier to do if you have an optimistic prover, because there's more flexibility.
No, that's helpful. So I know it's Friday and we're getting up to the top of the hour, but I have to ask you guys a couple more topic areas, two more key ones. One is on the ability for developers to use Arbitrum and how easy it is with Stylus. But I want to ask you a bit of a broader question. Like, there's a massive kind of developer debate on where to deploy, like ETHEL1, Solana, build your own Cosmos chain, like ThorChain, Akash, you know, DYDX. Like, there's great examples there. There's, you know, optimistic rollups on Ethereum. There's ZK rollups on Ethereum. There's roll your own rollup and post the DA to Eigenlayer and Celestia, right? Like, I'm starting to get confused and I feel bad developers even have this many options. How do you guys see this playing out? Is it too many options? Do they get annoyed? Do they go to a Solana because they don't want to have to worry about this stuff? Like, what is your broader thesis on all of this?
Well, so there are a lot of possibilities and you can kind of put them into categories if you like, right? That might simplify things a bit. So you can go to Ethereum. You can go to an alt L1 because I think we're now in the space where Ethereum is the big dog as far as layer one smart contract chains go. You can go to an alt L1. You can go to an L2, you can launch your own chain. To me, those are kind of the first dimension of choice that you have there. And we could talk about the pros and cons of each of those. We're obviously big believers in the last two, either going to an L2 and Arbitrum being our favorite, obviously, or else launch your own chain using Arbitrum Orbit. So, and Stephen could talk, I guess, more about Orbit.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Orbit itself, by the way, has many, many options. Just this week, Celestia announced, for example, the integration of Celestia with Orbit. So you can do that. And there are definitely a ton of options here. The Arbitrum Orbit program, I think, is very interesting because it allows people to take the full Arbitrum Nitro stack, as well as Arbitrum Stylus, Bold, all the innovations that we've discussed today, to deploy their own chain with it. So Arbitrum is the leading ecosystem today when it comes to building applications. But a lot of developers now, there's this new interest and tendency to, among some, to want to graduate from an application to build their own chain. And there's you could do a whole other podcast on whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. And the answer is really, like all good things, it depends. But Orbit program is also non-monolithic. You can build an Arbitrum Orbit program that's a roll-up that settles to Ethereum, that's an AnyTrust chain that uses Celestia, that uses something else. And I think this is definitely a bit confusing, I would say, for some, for sure. And I think there are also, one thing I'll focus on, there are sort of different schools of thoughts out there as to how many rollups there will be and how do we think about this. One analogy that, you know, is helpful for me is I like to think of this as sort of like TV channels. And the idea is that it's clear to us if every TV show decided it wanted to become a TV channel, like it would make no sense at all, right? You'd have most of the day of like no programming and like you'd have everyone having to negotiate their own distribution deals or an advertise that would be terrible. And that's why what we've done is we have channels that group, you know, programs that are similar. So you'll have the cartoons on Cartoon Network. You'll have, if you're interested in nature, you'll have Discovery, you know, National Geographic. And the idea is there'll also be an overlap, right? There might be cartoons about nature that can go either way. It's not an exact science, but the idea is that you're going to have chains that are grouped, I think, really around interesting things to do and around, you know, the users that might use them. So I might have a gaming chain or a DeFi chain or an NFT chain. I'm personally not of the opinion that we're going to have a million chains or anything like that. I think we're going to have strong verticals similar to like we do of groups of chains. And there are, you know, when it comes to even discovery of projects, that it just helps a lot. If I'm a gamer on a gaming chain and, oh, I can look at another project on the chain that I'm already on, and you already have your audience built in there. So that's basically, you know, what I think. And how I got here from your question is the next point, which I'll make briefly, which is, you know, I think ultimately we're on the technology level today, there's a ton of experimentation and people are experimenting with different technology, different data layers. But ultimately, it might make sense for different use cases to use different ones. For example, we have in the Arbitrum ecosystem, Arbitrum 1 and Arbitrum Nova. Arbitrum 1 puts its data on Ethereum. Arbitrum Nova opts to use a data availability committee, which means much lower cost and also targets a different set of the applications, you know, gaming and social applications, which that's a good trade-off for. So I think each of these communities will ultimately make different trade-offs that are really targeted towards the success of their community. Because, you know, for a DeFi project, the 10 cents transaction fee or might make sense, and it's fine for many users. If you're a gaming project or a social project, you know, paying 10 cents every time you want to make a move in a game or every time you want to, you know, post something on social media, your wallet might get drained very quickly. So ultimately, I think we're going to have to abstract a lot of the technical talk away, and we're going to actually have to focus on use cases and simplify this for users and also consolidate. So I think having so many options just super confusing for users. I think we're going to have to really say to them, hey, this is a good option for this vertical, and we as a community are going to have to get consensus here. I think we're very much still in the experimentation phase, and it's great. There are lots of people experimenting. Lots of people want to be the one or two or three solutions that we ultimately consolidate to. And I think it's not clear there what it is, but ultimately I think the experimentation is important, but we need to consolidate. And I think even on Solana, by the way, they're going to see experimentation there with different data models, with mixed, you know, I don't think that will necessarily be limited to Ethereum. I think any blockchain that sees immense traffic, obviously Solana's set its bar of what it will do on the layer one higher, but I think when you look at world scale, you're still going to need to see different solutions come forth. So I would just say Ethereum is maybe further along in this process, partially because, you know, of its ecosystem being, in my opinion, stronger, but also because it's opted to have lower data, lower capacity on the layer one. But I don't think any ecosystem that's ultimately going to serve, you know, the world is going to be immune to these problems at some point in its life cycle.
That's an excellent answer, Steven. So with Nitro, you can build your own chains, and obviously the fees would be lower and it would be fast. Are you able to make offer the level of customization that a lot of the successful Cosmos chains yearn for? Like when you look at what's launched on Cosmos, which is like the poster child for launching your own blockchain, like there's very technical reasons why people launch there, like whether you're ThorChain or whether you're DYDX or what have you. Do you think that you'll be able to offer that level of customization on the technical side, or is it just the idea of lower fees for a specific use case?
I mean, there's a lot of customization that is possible. From the standpoint of producing a product, we're trying to figure out which customizations people tend to want. When we listen to what the market is telling us and what the, you know, developers who are coming to us are telling us, there's certain things they tend to want. And we're trying to really focus on providing that. In principle, an Arbitrum technology chain could support really any application. You can provide the same level of customizability that that Cosmos makes possible. Question is the market really going to be demanding that? Because that's really what's going to drive, I think, what we end up building.
No, that's helpful. And I'm not as up to speed on Orbit, but I will be once I dive in after. One of the key questions, though, that I see time and time again with Optimistic, ZK, what have you, is just the bridging between rollups, right? It seems like that's a really hard thing to solve. Like Cosmos has it solved. Solana, this obviously isn't an issue because its composability is like native. How are you guys approaching that side, or is it like unsolved right now?
I'd say a few things about bridging. One is there's a lot of open questions about user experience. What is the best user experience for bridging where it's easy for a user, but also doesn't make it too easy to make mistakes? That, you know, doesn't make it too easy to make tragic mistakes in bridging. I think that's one piece of it, and experimentation is continuing to go on. On Arbitrum, there are a lot of our approach in Arbitrum has not been to say we're going to build the one true bridge on and off of Arbitrum. We've really been focused on enabling an ecosystem of bridging products and bridging services to be able to move liquidity on and off of Arbitrum as easily as possible, and building the support that they need in order to build those products. The last thing I'd say is that when you're moving across chains, you are in some sense crossing a trust boundary. And so there will necessarily be at least a little bit of friction moving across there. And there sort of should be, because the user, you kind of want the user to at least stop and think, do I really want to move my money to this other place? And I think that's one of the core challenges, is making, how do you make it easy while at the same time not making it so easy to make a mistake?
One of the other things here is the ability also to, so we announced yesterday that Arbitrum Orbit is mainnet ready, and initial cohort of 10 chains announced that, you know, 10 projects announced that they're building Orbit chains. There are lots more coming, but that was sort of the initial 10 that we're ready to announce. Many of the Orbit chains are layer threes, which means that they're built on top of the Arbitrum 1 or Arbitrum Nova chain, in most cases Arbitrum 1. And when it comes to bridging, you know, one aspect here is also the cost of onboarding, the cost of bridging. So there's the time and friction, there's also the cost, which obviously leads to the friction. And here, I think layer threes have a significant advantage when it comes to onboarding users because of bridging costs. So say that you have your funds in Coinbase, right? And you want to get to this new app chain. If that's a layer three chain, right, then you're going to have to withdraw from Coinbase to Arbitrum and then from Arbitrum to your layer three chain. And great, you just had two Arbitrum transactions. If that's a layer two chain, you have to go from Coinbase to Ethereum, Ethereum to your chain. Those are two Ethereum transactions. And if Arbitrum transactions, which they are, Arbitrum 1 transactions are 95%+ cheaper than Coinbase transactions, it means that you'll have a 95%, sorry, than Ethereum transactions, you'll have now a 95% plus advantage of onboarding to a layer three than you would to a layer two. So I think that that's also something which building on top of scalable infrastructure and continuing to leverage a lot of the scaling that Arbitrum has already done in the bridging design, in the onboarding design is something that's extremely powerful.
Yeah, no, that is really helpful. Guys, I wanna close out with like a devil's advocate take or something that I see a lot on Twitter, which is just like a centralization risk around Arbitrum. I see a lot of mentions around like half-baked answers, some like weird, some I don't understand on like what the sequencer actually does and what decentralization of it actually means. Could we dive into that just and close out on that topic? Because I feel like it's important.
Yep. So first, what does the sequencer do? The sequencer has one and only one job, and that's the only thing it's trusted to do. And that is to create and certify a list of which transactions have arrived at the sequencer and in what order. So basically, users' transactions are sent to the sequencer publishes a feed of which transactions it's received. That's its only job. It's just to certify which transactions have arrived. It doesn't decide what is the result of those transactions. It doesn't decide, it's not trusted to decide if they're valid or not. It's not trusted to decide how much fee they pay or anything like that. It just says, this is the sequence of transactions that have arrived, and therefore this is the sequence of transactions that the chain will try to execute. So if you're used to thinking about Ethereum, where you have the mempool, which is all of the transactions that have been submitted that are kind of waiting to get included. So the job of the sequencer is to produce something like a mempool, a list of transactions that have arrived, but in order. And so then what's going to happen, the execution layer of the chain, it's going to take those transactions in order and try to execute them one at a time and determine what their result is and how much fee they pay and all of that. So all of that execution layer, that is what's done by the roll-up protocol and so on. The sequencer's only job is just to say which transactions have arrived and in which order. That's its only role.
One thing to add on to that is everything Ed said, that's its only role in the Arbitrum ecosystem. And that's because in the Arbitrum ecosystem, we have another set of roles, which are called the validators. So the idea is, what is the sequencer trusted? Let's say the sequencer posts bad transactions and tries to take money from your account. Well, in the Arbitrum ecosystem, it can't. Just like we discussed before, if someone creates a bad history, the chain's going to correct it. That requires fraud proofs. That requires this proving system, this correct instruction system, which requires this network of validators to basically submit those fraud proofs, which we got like deep into earlier in the podcast. But in other networks that don't have the fraud proofs live, don't have validators because there's no proofs, there's no mechanism to correct Ethereum, in those systems, the sequencer actually is like the dictator. So the sequencer goes ahead and says, this is the state of the chain, and there is no one checking it. There are no proofs that are checking it. And I think a lot of the misconception comes because there are other chains that are using the term sequencer, but it's doing a lot more than sequencing. It's literally telling you what the correctness is, and it can go ahead and take money out of your account, post bad transactions, really wreak havoc, do whatever it wants. And users or no one actually, there's no group of people that has any recourse, other than maybe the developers of the chain who have centralized control that can undo things. You know, the sequencer is really the dictator in those chains. And the Arbitrum ecosystem, because it doesn't have decentralized, because it already has decentralized validation, the sequencer's role is very little. But there's a lot of people or different chains that use these terms differently. I think that leads to confusion. Now, when it comes to ordering, you know, as Ed was saying, there is also the ability to further decentralize ordering. We have a proposal called Time Boost, which is an ordering proposal. We're working with Espresso to build out a decentralized version of Time Boost, which will decentralize that ordering capacity, right? Because the worst thing the sequence circuit can do today is it can reorder transactions or delay transactions, and that's not good. But that's sort of the worst that the sequencer can do today, because it controls sequencing and it can change the sequencing. The arbitrary sequencer does not do that today, but today that's a centralized guarantee. So you can ask, hey, how can we decentralize the guarantee? So I'll know that it has to follow whatever policy, and you know, in this case, the time boost policy, how can we guarantee that? And that's where, you know, the focus of decentralizing the arbitrary sequencer comes in. That is important, and I'm not trying to minimize it, but yeah, sometimes people conflate that with fraud proofs, and that's a totally separate thing in the arbitrary ecosystem.
Yeah. So decentralizing a overall system like Arbitrum is something that happens in many steps. I think it's fair to say that Arbitrum is farther down that decentralization road than other L2s, in some cases much farther. And decentralizing the sequencer, I think, will be, I would say the last significant step in that decentralization journey.
No, it is. I guess just like an understanding question, like, if the sequencer acts maliciously on misordering a transaction or some sort of delay, it's not the god here, because you could always submit a fraud proof. Is that the idea?
The fraud proof is about what happens when you execute the transactions that are in the sequence. But there is a backup measure. If the sequencer just refuses to include your transaction, there is a method where you can post your transaction on Ethereum, and then a bit later you can force it into the sequence. So the sequencer is not able in the Arbitrum protocol to keep transactions out. If you want your transaction in, you can force it in regardless of what the sequencer does. That will involve a delay. But and one of the reasons why we would like to move toward toward decentralized sequencing is that you can get stronger protection against a spiteful sequencer that is trying to delay your transactions.
It's crazy how much nuance is lost on crypto Twitter. Sometimes it's the best place. Sometimes the memes make it the worst. Honestly, guys, I learned a lot on this podcast. I had no idea how the interactive fraud proofs worked. I had no idea the centralization meme around the sequencer, how wrong that kind of was. I really appreciate both of your time. I'm really excited to share the episode around.
Likewise, thanks. It's fun to work on this stuff. It's fun to talk about. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.